Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sanaa Abrar of United We Dream, who discusses her group's current campaign to pressure Congress to defund ICE and U.S. Customs and Border Protection in order to disable the U.S. Trump Deportation Force. Panayotis Solkas of the Campaign to Fight Toxic Prisons, who examines the links between environmental justice and mass incarceration. And Anthony Rogers Wright of the Center for Sustainable Economy, who assesses the proposed federal Green New Deal resolution in Congress and parallel campaigns to win Green New Deal initiatives at the state and local level. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In his first days as Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known affectionately as AMLO, proposed a Marshall-like aid plan for the impoverished and violence-plagued nations of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. AMLO committed to investing $30 billion in the three Central American nations over 5 years. López Obrador, who ran on a bold, progressive agenda in Mexico's election last July, plans to move more resources into regional development rather than security in order to slow the flow of migrants moving north into Mexico and the U.S. Obrador's initiative won praise from the United Nations Commission on Latin America, but has not been supported by the Trump administration. Many progressives in Latin America support AMLO's aims, but are skeptical that it can fundamentally reshape the lives among Central America's poor citizens. Jeff Thayil of the Washington Office on Latin America opined it's a long way from saying it's a good idea for a regional economic plan to mobilizing resources and get free of corruption and mismanagement. ProPublica reports executives at pharmaceutical giant Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, which helped to trigger the U.S. opioid crisis, considered capitalizing on the addiction treatment market, while at the same time trying to boost sales of their controversial opioid drug. ProPublica's review of the civil complaint revealed that members of the Sackler family, which controls Purdue Pharma, pushed for higher doses of OxyContin, guided efforts to mislead doctors and the public about the drug's addictive capacity, blaming misuse on patients. The complaint alleges that the concerns about doctors improperly prescribing the drug and patients becoming addicted were swept aside in an aggressive effort to drive OxyContin sales ever higher. The Sackler family is well known for its philanthropy in the art world, but now a group of activists has called on organizations to stop accepting Sackler contributions and for the family name to be stripped from some institutions. Aggressive marketing of OxyContin is blamed by some analysts for propelling the crisis that has resulted in 200,000 overdose deaths related to prescription opioids since 1999. In launching her presidential campaign, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has revived the idea of a wealth tax on America's super rich. The progressive Democrat calls for imposing a 2% tax on households worth over $50 million and 3% on assets above $1 billion, affecting only 75,000 households. The proposal provoked an outcry from billionaires Michael Bloomberg and Howard Schultz, both of whom have presidential aspirations. In contrast to discussion of a wealth tax, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is proposing to repeal the already weakened federal estate tax that impacts fewer than 2,000 of the nation's wealthiest families a year. Many Democratic Party policy advisors believe that a wealth tax has wide public appeal. Jean Sperling, who worked for Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, declared wealth inequality in our country is a national scandal. Seth Hanlon of the Center for American Progress praised Warren for proposing something bold to get at our tax code's failure to tax major accumulations of wealth. According to the New Yorker magazine, two University of California at Berkeley economists say Warren's wealth tax would generate $2.75 trillion over a decade, even with a predicted increase in tax avoidance behavior among the super rich. Warren's tax proposal also calls for a significant increase in the IRS tax enforcement budget and a minimum audit rate for wealthy households subject to the new levy. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After the longest government shutdown in U.S. history ended on January 25th, another deadline loomed on February 15th. Democratic and Republican congressional negotiators said on February 11th that they had reached a budget agreement in principle to prevent another government shutdown by funding border security, while including no money for President Trump's proposed southern border wall. Mr. Trump could accept the bipartisan deal while still retaining the option to issue an executive order declaring a national emergency in order to bypass Congress to get border wall funding. But as budget talks continued, United We Dream, the largest immigrant youth-led organization in the country, pressed their campaign to defund U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and U.S. Immigration and Border Protection, CBP, federal agencies that the activist group describes as Trump's deportation force. In their new report titled The Truth About ICE and CBP, United We Dream describes the constant violent abuses that immigrant youth, children, and their families suffer at the hands of these agencies every day. Your reporter spoke with Sanaa Abrar, United We Dream's advocacy director, who talks about the report and the reasons why her group is now pressuring Congress to defund these immigration enforcement agencies.
One example of a story that we've included in this report, which is available at thedeportationforce.com, is the story of Miguel. Miguel is a New Jersey resident. He's also a DACA recipient. He was on his way to get coffee in the morning in his car, and he was blocked at the end of a road in his own neighborhood by unmarked vehicles. Two individuals came out of the vehicles, and they identified themselves as ICE agents. They asked him for his identification. Miguel provided his DACA. They challenged the validity of his DACA, and they actually took him into a detention camp in New Jersey, where he spent a few months actually incarcerated because of ICE. This is a DACA recipient, right? We would understand DACA as being protection from detention and deportation, but unfortunately, his isn't the only story. You know, when we talk about Border Patrol, there have been extremely high-profile cases that have come up in recent months as a result of Border Patrol abuses. One of the stories has been of Jacqueline Call, a very young Guatemalan girl who came to the United States, crossed the border with her father and a group of immigrants who were coming to this country. She ended up dying in Border Patrol custody. And this was partly a result of the conditions of the camp that she was being kept in. There's also the case of Felipe Alonso Munoz, who was in a very similar situation, very young boy who died on Christmas Day in Border Patrol custody. We highlight the cases of many stories and firsthand examples of the abuses of ICE and CBP. This report that we have goes through 144 unique reports from 2018 that basically draws a pattern of not only the abuses of ICE and Border Patrol, but collaboration in certain localities between local law enforcement and ICE. We also do the work of organizing the loved ones of those who are in detention to take action. So, for example, last week as well as this week, United We Dream is bringing families of individuals in detention to Washington, D.C. to lobby on their behalf. Last week, with the release of this report, we actually had families of detained individuals going from office to office on Capitol Hill dropping off this report, essentially saying, this is my story. That's the policy. That's the evidence. And these are the stories that you need so that you can understand completely why we need to defund these agencies. And we'll be doing the same this week as well, and ensuring that the stories of those who may be miles and miles away in a detention cell, their stories are still being heard among policymakers and their staff.
What's been the response of congresspeople you've spoken with and your organization has contacted about your pressure being exerted to defund Customs and Border Protection and ICE? There are a lot of people in the country who believe the nation needs a force at the border to regulate immigration. I wonder how you respond to that or how you approach that particular issue with Congress.
I have hope. I can literally feel the winds of change blowing. Last Thursday, we had the great honor of being not only with families of those who have been detained at a press event, but also with Congresswomen Presley, Tlaib, Omar, and Ocasio-Cortez, calling for the defunding of the agencies of ICE and Border Patrol. We've also had success in the past with members signing on to letters calling for reductions in funding for ICE and Border Patrol, both on the House and the Senate side. For example, last year we were able to get the support of about 83 House Democrats onto a letter in 2018 calling for reductions. That same year, we were able to get about 20 or so senators to also call for reductions in funding. And those are the tactics that we are continuing to employ and to escalate upon to get members of Congress to understand that they can take action. We are finding that it is becoming increasingly not only a conversation point, but a battle cry for many members of Congress. So we look forward to continuing to use tools like our report, as well as bringing in families to really explore and expose, honestly, the human consequences of what ICE and Border Patrol are doing, so that members of Congress have the tools that they need to show why it is so necessary to defund these agencies.
That was Sanaa Abrar, Advocacy Director with the immigrant youth-led group United We Dream. Learn more about their campaign to defund federal immigration enforcement agencies and find a copy of their new report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Starting in late January and lasting almost a week, frigid temperatures in the single digits in the Northeast coincided with a breakdown in the heating system at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. More than 1,600 inmates there had no heat, went without hot meals, hot water for showers, or light in their cells. For security reasons, inmates were placed on lockdown in their cells, where the temperatures were the coldest. One inmate reported that a third blanket he was using to try to keep warm was taken away by guards, who said that by regulation, inmates could have no more than two blankets. Family members of prisoners, and others outraged by the situation, rallied daily outside the complex, demanding their loved ones be moved until heat was restored. At one point, a group of protesters were pepper sprayed by guards. In the end, the prisoners were not moved, but after several days, heat and hot water were restored. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Panayoti Solkas. He co-founded the Prison Ecology Project of the Human Rights Defense Center to research the intersection of the prison system and environmental contamination, as well as the impacts of climate change on penal institutions. Here, Solkas, now an organizer with a campaign to fight toxic prisons, examines the links between environmental justice and mass incarceration.
I track issues with prisons and jails and detention facilities all over the country, overlaps between environmental protection and mass incarceration, and looking at the intersections of climate justice and of pollution and how those things are related to criminal justice and the prison system. And I know from following similar stories all across the country that this is not a rare occasion when power goes out for days or weeks at a time. The extreme weather often is the cause of the major environmental situation, you know, environmental justice issue arising. So in this case, possibly because of a spike in cold weather causing stress on regional utilities, that may have been related. You know, a lot of prison facilities, whether they're new or old, are built with, you know, substandard infrastructure, so the old ones are even worse. Prisons exist almost as this domestic third world captive nation or nation inside, people have referred to, and that exists on many levels, you know, on labor standards. So prisoners work, but they're not protected by basic labor laws. Prisoners face environmental problems that we've been tracking, but it often looks more like the conditions of a maquiladora south of the border, where environmental regulations are either very relaxed or non-existent because what's happening is occurring behind closed doors or on the other side of a fence or a wall. So the situation at MDC, you know, it needs to be put in context, I think, with the national, you know, picture of incarceration in this country. Sadly, it's not shocking. Maybe days or weeks before news broke about the MDC power outages, there was viral videos from Chicago of prison slaves, shoveling snow in like blizzard conditions. Over the course of a year before that, I could point to a dozen cases where prisoners were caught in floods or conditions during or post-hurricane being horrendous on the coast of Florida and South Carolina. Here in Florida, on both coasts of the state, as red tide was sweeping through the Gulf and then circling around the Atlantic, which it rarely does, but extreme weather conditions have affected a lot of weather and patterns in ways that are kind of unexpected or unanticipated. And they had prison slaves, picking up toxic dead fish piled up on the shores. So, these are all things to me, these are all intersections of climate justice and prison abolition. And I think it's important to view the atrocities at the Metropolitan Detention Center with that lens. This overlap between environmental justice and mass incarceration is kind of like climaxing as the climate itself is destabilizing. It's increasing numbers of prisoners die from extreme heat every year, but extreme cold should not be neglected.
Panayoti Salkas, as a prison abolitionist, I don't know what your view is about small reform steps, but in this Brooklyn Detention Center case, the warden was criticized for not having an emergency plan in place, like even just giving prisoners extra blankets, if not removing them from their freezing cells altogether.
Well, yeah, I think that's, obvious. As a prison abolitionist, I think, conditions of confinement and daily struggles around reform are the foundation of the movement, how we build networks of support on the inside and outside. And so I think, of course, we have to grapple with these issues as they come and put them in context of fundamental change, ultimately creating a system so distinct that I don't think the same words would even apply. We want to change the criminal justice system so fundamentally that it will be unrecognizable.
Well, people might be wondering what a prison abolitionist thinks about people taking responsibility for their actions and what kind of accountability you think is just.
I guess I view the transition from what we currently have to what we want and what we will have at some point, sooner the harder we push, that communities are empowered to deal with conflict in ways that make sense locally, regionally, culturally. And of course, this is the criminal justice system that predated nation states and large scale kind of empire building governments. So we know it's feasible because it's been done for the thousands of years of recorded history prior to current forms of government that we now see. So I guess I look to that as the model. And I think it still happens in many neighborhoods, especially with youth, where communities come together and deal with a conflict or problem in an attempt to avoid dealing with law enforcement, especially communities that know the repercussions to be so severe and so biased. So I think tapping into that, and understanding how that can and should work, a lot of crime, so-called crime, stems from inequality and injustice, fundamentally. So addressing mental health needs, viewing drugs as a social and health crisis, not a criminal issue. If it weren't for the criminal aspect, I think a lot of the social harm around it would be reduced significantly. So those are things, for example, that I feel like are steps towards the bigger picture of dealing with the crisis at MDC that happened in the previous weeks.
That was Panayoti Salkas, an organizer with a campaign to fight toxic prisons. Learn more about the campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the months before and after the November 2018 midterm election, discussion and debate on the Green New Deal drew attention to the climate crisis while offering a set of bold policy prescriptions to address climate change. The non-binding joint resolution, sponsored by Democratic Rising Star, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Massachusetts Democratic Senator Edward Markey, lays out a plan for a decade-long mobilization to transform the U.S. economy and move to a carbon-free energy future. The resolution's preamble states that America is in the midst of two crises, a climate crisis and an economic crisis of rising inequality. To address the climate crisis, the resolution spells out 5 goals, 14 projects, and 15 requirements. The measure aims to upgrade the nation's infrastructure, revitalize energy systems, retrofit buildings, and restore ecosystems. As the Green New Deal reduces greenhouse gas emissions, water and air pollution, its sponsors say it would also create millions of new family-sustaining jobs. Those employment opportunities would go first to working-class families and communities of color, as economic disparity in the U.S. has increased. Your reporter spoke with Anthony Rogers Wright, a board member with the Portland, Oregon-based Center for a Sustainable Economy, who assesses the strengths and weaknesses of the proposed federal Green New Deal resolution, with a focus on the need to halt the development of new fossil fuel infrastructure.
First and foremost, kudos to the activists and the organizers on the ground who push for this and have gotten it to the point that it's at. It's also important for people to understand that what was introduced by Representative Ocasio-Cortez as well as Senator Markey is not policy. It's not a bill as much as it's a resolution and a very bold and forward-thinking mission statement. And that's not to diminish the need for a very bold mission statement coming from people's government as it pertains to addressing the climate crisis, which of course is a quintessential threat, not just to the United States, but the entire world. But it's just for people to understand that even if, the president saw the light and did sign it, it would still be equivalent, if you will, to the Paris Climate Accords, which are not legally enforceable, right? At the same time, there are some issues with it in that it did leave out mention of getting the country off of fossil fuels altogether. And it also left the door open for potentially the use of nuclear energy, as the language of the resolution really just focuses on net zero emissions, right? And the problem with that is that it opens the door up for the concept or the idea of a Green New Deal to be co-opted. For instance, in my home state, I live in Seattle now, but grew up in New York City. In my home state, Governor Cuomo just introduced his version of the Green New Deal, which does in fact include the use of nuclear power. So you can see that we're already having a bit of an issue on what the overarching paradigm is, as to, hey, this would qualify as a Green New Deal, and this set of policies would not. So I think that what this is really opening the door to is something that I've actually been advocating for as it pertains to climate policy in general, is that this is really going to have to be a bottom-up process led by local grassroots organizing, especially groups representing frontline communities like the Climate Justice Alliance, like Got Green in Seattle, Front and Centered in Seattle, Opal in Portland, and other frontline groups throughout the country. And I think that that's a really, really good thing, because I think the people do have a lot more power at the local level. Like for instance, I wrote a letter to my governor, Jay Inslee, about my concerns with his leadership on climate change. And wouldn't you know it, I have a meeting with him this Friday morning as a result.
Anthony, in the Green New Deal resolution as it's proposed, is there an explicit call for a moratorium on fossil fuel infrastructure? In other words, things like new natural gas pipelines, fracking, and all the rest. Is there an explicit call to end the public investment into these infrastructure projects, which will last another generation?
Right. No, there is not. And that is why, while it's being applauded by amazing groups like the Climate Justice Alliance, which includes the Indigenous Environmental Network, who both said that, this framework overall is very, very good, yet we are very concerned about the fact that it is not calling for this outright moratorium by X amount of time of fossil fuel infrastructure. And this is completely different than two better, I don't want to say better than the Green New Deal, but two of the better climate policies policies that have been released in so many years. A senator in Oregon right now, as a matter of fact, Jeff Merkley's 100 by 50 Act, which did call for a fossil fuel moratorium by 2050. And then, of course, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who is now running for president, her Off Fossil Fuels Act called for a moratorium on new fossil fuel infrastructure even sooner. And this is really important because SEEN, the organization I'm on the board of, as well as their sister organization, Center for Sustainable Economy, one of our strategies for really addressing this is a fossil fuel risk bonds, which we're hoping would be so expensive that people would just not bother with constructing and trying to permit new fossil fuel infrastructure, as well as an outright fossil fuel moratorium, similar to what was passed, as I said previously, in Portland, Oregon, and more recently in King County, Washington.
Anthony, I did want to ask you about what has been accomplished by your organization in King County, Washington. Tell us a bit about the fossil fuel moratorium that you and your organization were able to pass there and its immediate and long-term effects.
In terms of what we accomplished in King County, amazing local organizing, groups like 350 Seattle, as well as groups like Front and Centered and Got Green. What happened was that we were able to get county commissioners to vote for a six-month moratorium. And within that 6 months, take part and commence studies. It's limited in scope to some extent, and it certainly also gives people, time to keep organizing and to keep the pressure on to their county commissioners while also sending a message to other counties in Washington State to hopefully follow suit.
That was Anthony Rogers Wright, a board member with the Portland, Oregon-based Center for Sustainable Economy. Learn more about the center's initiatives on halting public funding for fossil fuel infrastructure by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KODX in Seattle, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.